You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, wrapped up in books.
Yes, hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. On our show today, our studio guest is debut novelist Megan Hunter, talking about her novel The End We Start From. We've also hear from Sarah Turner, aka The Unmumsy Mum, talking about her latest book, The Unmumsy Mum Diary, and another winner from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. But as I say, our studio guest today is Megan Hunter. Hello, Megan.
Hello, Lee.
Hi. Nice to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
Now, we'll be talking to Sarah Turner later, the Unmumsy Mum, about motherhood and writing. Your novel, The End We Start From, could you have written that, do you think, before you became a mother? You're a mother of quite young children.
I mean, it's always a difficult question whether you could have written a book without having had that experience. I mean, certainly a lot of my own experience feeds into the book, although my children were quite a lot older than the baby in the book when I wrote it. So on the other hand, I think I needed that distance, really, that time provides to see it in a new light. You know, I don't think I could have written exactly the same book without having had my children. Certainly a lot of my own physical experiences fed into the book.
It is very visceral about labour and breastfeeding and being pregnant.
Yes, yeah, I wanted to include all of that. I mean, it's such an important part for me, so central to the experience, that the physical experiences of pain, but also of pleasure, really, that I wanted to sort of to write about that in terms of, you know, often we hear about. Well, we often hear about the more negative side, perhaps. But I wanted to actually also really really embrace the more sensuous side of the experience.
Earthy elements, I suppose.
Yeah. So I was looking for the right words there. Really, I think it's something that I wanted to put into words. Perhaps because it is difficult to put into words, I wanted to write a book about it because it's something that can be actually difficult to voice. You know, it's perhaps at baby groups, etc. It's easier to talk about the development of your baby, and less easy to talk about your own physical experiences, and particularly perhaps if they're of pleasure or of pain, of damage that can come from birth, or of isolation or fear or of sadness. All those things can be very difficult to voice.
And because you are a mother of young children and your narrator in the book is a mother of a very young child, have you found that people have confused the two of you? I suppose that may happen anyway when a narrator is a female and the author is a female.
I think that does happen a lot to women, and I also think that writing a first-person account makes that more likely. People have, I think, confused me with a narrator, and it's sort of quite important for me to say that she's not me, and I did write her very much imagining somebody else, imagining a character. She is a character for me. She's a person who exists. She's a very real person who is not me. Of course, my own experience feeds into her experience, and it's very interesting and dynamic process how that happens. It's quite mysterious to me when you're writing and suddenly a memory comes back. Someone said to me the other day, "Oh, I remember when you were camping with your son when he was a baby, and there was that sort of flash flood."
And
I'd completely forgotten about that, or forgotten how that might relate to the book. And I was like, yes.
Because there's a flirt as we'll discuss in the book.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a mother of a very young baby, and there's a catastrophic flood in London. Obviously, this was not the same proportions, but the fact that we were in a tent meant that, you know, all of our things were wet, the duvet, the, you know, my books that I'd taken were all ruined. You know, it was that experience of water really rushing in and ruining sort of a home, really, even a temporary home. And so I'd forgotten how that experience had you know, inevitably fed into the book. But I think it helps really for things to be buried, and then for fiction to bring them out.
That's quite spooky, isn't it?
Strange, yes, yeah.
Well, we'll come back. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. We're going to hear your first track of music now, which is Marvin Gaye and Mercy, Mercy Me. Why this one?
I love this album. This whole album's so beautiful. And really, I mean, just, you know, especially at the moment and the current political situation, and particularly, you know, with reference to our relationship to the environment, it's just such a beautiful lament, really, for what are we doing to this planet and what are we leaving behind for our children.
Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
That was Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye, the first choice of music from our guest today on Bookmark, Megan Hunter. Megan's debut novel, The End We Start From, was published earlier this year in the UK by Picador. Set in an imagined future in which London is submerged below floodwaters, an unnamed narrator is forced to flee for safety, having just given birth to her first child. It'll soon be out in America, France, Canada and Portugal, and the film rights have already been snapped up by Benedict Cumberbatch's production company, Sunnymark. Hardly surprising when it's been garnering such rave reviews. The Sunday Times described it as haunting. The Guardian says it keeps the reader pinned to the page. The Financial Times described it as a haunting debut, and The Independent said it was a tender and tremendous story. Well, I could go on, Megan. The list of plaudits is endless. We could spend an entire hour reading these amazing reviews of your book. How does it feel to hear your novel, your debut novel, described like that?
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, it's almost too much to take in. I think I'll be taking it in for a long time to come.
I suppose when you're working on it, sitting, you know, at a desk in a cafe or in your room, you dream of this.
Absolutely. I think so. And then I think it's funny because when I actually wrote the book, I didn't think with this particular book, I was really thinking about it as being, you know, eventually published at all. So it's particularly strange for me with this book. I mean, genuinely, the reaction, everything that's happened has been a total surprise and a delight, obviously, but a bit of a shock initially.
A lovely shock. Yes. Well, I described it as a novel. I actually had to go back to the jacket, the book jacket, to check that you described it as a novel, because it could be described as a prose poem or a novella. How do you describe it?
Well, I like, somebody said recently it's a novel with the sensibility of poetry. I like that a lot because I think I was very interested in how you can tell a story, but sort of using a lot of the features of poetry, really. And it's sort of very, I think of it as being very influenced by poetry. It is obviously prose, what I wanted to do is really create that sense that you have with poetry, that every single word counts. Also, that there is a sort of real emphasis and weight on each word, and that there's a lot of space around the words for the reader to really sort of create the story for themselves.
And you allow a lot of space for that. So that it's a story about a small group of people and the world out there we never really see a great deal of. And your characters are initials. You don't give them full names.
No, I mean, I think that came very naturally to me when I started to write the book. It didn't seem as though they could have names, and it just, I did it really quite instinctively. But then looking back, I am asked quite a lot, why did I do that? And then I've had to sort of think, well, why did I do that? And I think, you know, the one of the things that I say really is that when, you know, I often think about the intimacy of writing to someone, how you don't need their name. And if you love somebody, you probably don't think about, you know, them as Lee or as Megan. You know, you think about them in a more intimate way than that. They sort of transcend their name. So although I know, you know, it can have that distancing quality, and I appreciate that it does, and that it also has that sense of people being almost, you know, an every man and every woman. For me, it also has a real intimacy.
Did you actually know the names?
No, I don't think that I definitely, I mean, certainly for the narrator, I didn't think of her as having a name. I mean, for me, that was quite natural. There was something, I read a book for my A-level Surfacing by Margaret Atwood, where the narrator is unnamed. I mean, there are lots of unnamed narrators, but I think that one, you know, when you read books when you're younger and you study them, you know, for your exams, they can have quite a strong impact on you. I think that did have, you know, I felt the real naturalness of that in a way. For me, it doesn't feel like a strange thing. It feels like a natural thing. It feels like a level of intimacy and of knowledge of a character, which for me fiction should give.
Because it's written in this form, I mean, how did that form come about? Because you write prose and you write poetry. Were you always going to write a novel like this, or did it just sort of lend itself to that style?
I think that the book does lend itself particularly to the sort of broken up prose. They're almost like tiny reports from a situation. They're not in the detail of the sort of, well, there is detail, but there's not a sort of sense of you're in every second that is passing. The time is very broken up. I think that suits both the dystopian scenario and also the motherhood, early motherhood context. And I'd read other books, I'd read other books with those kind of forms, writers like Maggie Nelson, Jenny Offal, Anne Carson. So I was influenced by them. And then I found that writing in that more fragmentary way sort of brought out something in my writing that hadn't been there before.
Did you worry that it might make it less likely to be published because it is so unusual?
Well, I didn't really worry, but once I'd written it and I had it, I did sort of think, well, what am I going to do with this? You know, it's 17,000 words long, or 15,000 words, I think it was then. You know, I didn't really, it didn't seem as though it necessarily fit into those sort of, you know, categories of publishing. So that's part of the sort of the surprise, really, of everything that's happened since then.
Because it's too long to be a short story, though. It does, in a way, the circularity of it, without giving anything away, has the feel of a short story.
Yeah, I think, certainly I was writing short stories before I wrote it, as well as poetry. And I think that sort of condensed narrative does have something of the short story, although I think that because it's across a whole year and a huge amount happens, I suppose that gives it the more novelistic quality.
And the idea itself of a woman having a baby and then being forced to flee because of what's happened, we're looking at a future, a dystopian future, as you say, in which London is underwater. Where did that come from?
I think it came from
your camping trip.
Yes, although I'd forgotten about that. I think it's, you know, that sort of imagery. I think often in a poem you're playing a lot with the sort of with imagery and with a sort of nexus of metaphors. And I think I was playing with, for a long time in poetry and short stories, water, creation, birth, destruction. You know, so it's this, and you sort of learn to play. So that just worked. You know, there's the waters of life. It's obviously a biblical image. There's, you know, the waters that the baby grows in. Your waters break, and then there's that sense of, you know, the sea, as being a sort of threatening entity, which I've had for a long time, possibly from this, partly from camping beside this beach, but also obviously the environmental question of rising sea levels and of flooding, which, you know, affects so many people genuinely, you know, around the world. And so, yeah, it all just came together in this, yeah, almost quite sort of lucky way, really.
And it's interspersed, the narrative is interspersed with these extracts from various religions and myths around the world, mm-hmm. About the end of the world or the beginning of the world.
They were there from the beginning, those myths, and they always felt like they were important to give the book a different texture, a different context, a different point of reference. It's just really, for me, you know, without them, the book would be very much rooted in this one person's experience and in the present moment, in her present moment. And they really sort of, for me, give that additional sense of such a wider span of human history, really.
And we talked about motherhood. It's not really just about motherhood. There's a lot about parent-child relationships, son-mother, son-father relationships.
Yes, I mean, I think it was important to me for the baby to be a real character, you know, not as in he's a real character, but for him to be real and to feel as though he was a person, not just. And I think sometimes in books people have babies and then they're sort of carted, you know, that there's the baby in the pram, or, you know, the baby isn't really a full person, whereas I think babies are actually, you know, have their own characteristics, and from a very early age. And it's been pleasing to me when people have said, oh, I really felt that the baby was a character, because I wanted to write about babyhood, not just motherhood and fatherhood as well, and the whole sort of family dynamic, really. It is obviously, it's very centred on the woman's experience. She's the narrator, it's the first person. But, you know, some people have said to me, and I've been pleased that they related to it almost from the baby's perspective of having been mothered, even if they haven't been mothers themselves.
Well, thank you. We'll come back. We've got so much to talk about with this book. But speaking of motherhood, that leads us nicely to our first interview. Author, blogger and mum of two, Sarah Turner, is known to millions of parents as the Unmumsy Mum. Her first book, The Unmumsy Mum, a warts and all account of parenthood, was a Sunday Times number one bestseller. And her second, The Unmumsy Mum Diary, has had the same success. I met Sarah when she came to Heffer's Bookshop in Cambridge and asked her how she came to write the books.
I started off by writing a blog online called The Unmumsy Mum, which I then shared on social media. It just kind of took off to the extent that it was shared so widely on social media that I was approached by a publisher who said, well, you know, like the look of this, have you ever thought about writing a book? To which I was absolutely gobsmacked, but sort of thought, yeah, I can see it as a book. So yeah, so the book originates in the blog by the same name.
And what made you write the blog?
I found the first year of parenthood a big struggle. I'd gone back to work part-time. I found it quite frustrating that everybody else seemed to be coping so well, or so it seemed anyway, from what I was looking at online and reading articles and stuff. Everybody else seemed to be doing a much better job than I felt like I was doing. And then I sort of started having this suspicion that actually maybe there are other people that are having a hard day as well, but they're just not being open and honest and putting it out there. So I decided that I'd write something of my own and kind of pledged honesty as my number one thing to maintain at all times as I was writing. And yeah, I guess I didn't ever really have any expectations of where it would get to. I certainly never thought I would end up writing two books, you know, off the back of it, because I didn't have any following to start with. I couldn't ever see it ballooning to the level that it then did. So it was a pleasant surprise.
And what about the writing experience? Because it's one thing writing a blog, it's quite another thing to sit down and write a book.
Yeah, absolutely is. And I don't think I had any idea how intense the book writing experience is. Blogs were done, you know, of an evening, whenever I fancied it, I could pick and choose. I'm going to write about this now. I'm going to write for an hour between Emma Dale and the next Coronation Street, and I could kind of thrash out a blog post. The discipline that was required to write 70,000 words or 80,000 words surprised me. In the end, I found it easier than what I thought I would, because I enjoyed it. The chapters themselves aren't too dissimilar from the blogs. You know, they kind of have the same tone and feel. So when I broke it down and thought, actually, it's just like sitting down and writing 50 blog posts, it felt easier in a way than thinking you've got to write a book.
And you include, obviously, lots of information about your own family, your own children. How do you decide what to put in, what to leave out? You know, where do you draw the line and keep stuff private?
Yeah, I was very keen early on to write the book that I wished that I had found when I first became a mum. And therefore, I was quite happy that I was putting all of our lives and some quite personal information and experiences in there about us. The line, I think, as to what I can share and continue to share comes with the fact that as the boys get a bit older, so now that Henry's at school, I'm feeling slightly less comfortable about sharing so much of his life, because I feel like perhaps now that he's will soon maybe become aware of it, I would hate to ever put something online that would embarrass or humiliate him in some way. So it felt like I didn't mind so much that I was being quite exposing about them and their behaviours when they were young, you know, babies and toddlers. But as they start going through the school years, I think I'm going to have to draw the line and say, actually, you know, some things are just their experiences to have and for me not to share with others. So I might have to think of a different way of writing about parenting, perhaps writing about it more generally. I get sent lots of stories and anecdotes from other parents now online. So I'm almost able to continue the parenting narrative online, but without drawing on my own family's experiences. But yeah, it is a tricky one. I never know if I've put too much of their lives on the internet, but they're very much out there now and in books. So I'm happy with that decision, but we'll have to think about how much more I want to share of them moving forward, I think.
Because they're slightly too young to ask permission of, and they probably wouldn't understand it, would they?
No, they wouldn't. And actually, recently, I think it was in France, there was an article that somebody had written that came out that sort of said, actually, you know, parents are opening themselves up to being sued in future because children might say, well, you never had my permission to to write articles about me and post pictures of us on holiday and what have you. You know, we're never really able to gain their consent. And even if Henry was 10, I could have a conversation with him. Am I really getting his consent if he's too young to consent to it, really, to know what's going on? So I think you just have to take a common sense approach. And the test for me is always to think, if there had been social media and blogs and books around when my parents had me and my sister and we were young, would I mind if they'd documented the embarrassing and silly things I'd done age 3 or 4? Probably not. If they'd started talking about what I was doing at 11, that would have been different. So that's kind of how I try and reason with myself about what I should share in my head.
And what about on a day-to-day level? Do you experience things and think, oh, that'll go in the blog or that'll go in the book? You know, how do you enjoy things for what they are without thinking of their creative potential, I suppose?
That's a good question. Sometimes I do wonder if I'm ever fully living in the moment, because something will happen. It can be the most magical, wonderful moment, or it can be the most horrendous, horrific, disastrous meltdown somewhere. And quite often the first thing I think is, this would make a great post. In some ways is perhaps awful, you know, should we instead just think, we'll turn phones and cameras and things off and just enjoy it. But it's through documenting such moments that I've managed to carve myself a career where I'm able to spend more time with the children doing those things. So it's almost, the difficulty comes from the fact that my home life kind of is my work life, because my work life is writing about my home life. I don't know if there's ever really a clear divide. When we went to France in the summer, I trialled 4 days free of any social media and what have you, which may not sound like a lot, but from a social media addict like me, it was lovely. It did make me look at things slightly differently, in that I was sort of thinking, I'm really absorbing these moments as memories and not thinking, oh, what should I put as an Instagram caption, which is generally how I live my life. I don't actually mind. I think it's possible to live a moment, enjoy it, and still take a cheeky picture and upload it on the internet as well. I don't think it has to be one or the other.
The other argument is that you'll remember them, putting them in a safe base in a way, that you remember these incidents.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly with the second book, The Diary, it is a fairly true representation of a year in our family's life. And I would probably otherwise never have included that much detail about where we went and who we saw and what happened and their milestones and things. So it's actually become something that will be quite nice for us to look back on.
The books are very funny. And you were mentioning other books that you'd read earlier, preparing you for parenthood. Humour is often something that's missed out of those books.
I think so, yeah. I think they're often very factual. I guess that they're trying to steer you in a certain direction. So you might look at doing this baby sleep training method, or you want to feed your baby this way, or this is what will happen to your body over the 9 months of pregnancy. And there doesn't ever seem to be any humour. Whereas actually, even with pregnancy, labour, breastfeeding, those early few years, there is humour to be found at every step of the way. And quite often, I think humour is what has saved me from a really bad day, is when I've actually taken a step back and looked at the picture and thought, actually, this is really quite funny. Like, it's sad or tragic at the time if, you know, we've had to abandon a shopping trolley and leave the supermarket because the tantrums got so bad. But I know that years down the line, those are the moments where I'll kind of chuckle to myself. And I think if you share them, it allows other people to have a laugh, and kind of opens up that space for people to think, actually, yeah, my kids do that, and maybe I'm not on my own, and we're all in it together, rather than just seeing all the nice stuff on social media and then thinking, oh dear, my life doesn't look very much like theirs at all. Where am I going wrong?
These books have been translated into many languages.
Yeah.
Do you find different cultural reactions?
So the first book is just starting to come out in various other, I think it's about 10 different countries. So it's interesting. There were certain things such as, there's no translation for mumsy in German, and then therefore there can be no unmumsy. So I can't remember what I became, a Windelwahnsinn or something, which translates as nappy madness or diaper madness. Very strange. I don't know how it's going to go down in different countries or how it will be perceived. I suppose I hope that the unifying thing throughout is just that parenthood is a common ground like no other. So regardless of what language you speak or what your beliefs are, you've still got to raise these small people, and some of the challenges will be the same. So hopefully that will translate, but it'll be interesting to see. Yeah.
And if you had one piece of advice for mums, I know it's hard to narrow it down,
yeah,
but is there one thing that you would say to a mum?
Yeah, I think I would probably say to not be so hard on yourself. Mums and dads, actually, but just generally to sort of stop beating yourself up and always thinking, I'm not doing it right, or I could be doing better, or Lynn down the road's doing a much better job than I'm doing of raising a toddler, because all of a sudden you're at the school gates and they're off to school and you think, oh my goodness, I've wasted so much of this first 4 or 5 years worrying.
And you mentioned dads there. The book's equally applicable to dads.
It is. I get quite a few messages from dads that have read the blog and the books, actually. There are some things that are more centred around mum, particularly when it comes to, you know, pregnancy and labour and breastfeeding. But a lot of the behavioural day-to-day, just looking after children, covers both. The first book's very pink, so I get a lot of messages from dads to tell me that they've downloaded it for their Kindle because they didn't want to get it out on the tube. But generally, it's read by more dads than what I had imagined, which is good. We're in it together.
And you're still writing the blog. Are the two symbiotic in some way?
I find that I always get to a point when I've written the books and I'm also trying to just have some days where I'm being mum at home as well. There usually comes a point where something has to give. And the thing that normally goes by the wayside is the blog writing, because nobody's breathing down my neck for me to submit blog posts. So I don't write the blog as much as I would like to, but quite often when I do, that will then form the basis of a chapter in the book. So blog material is never wasted, you know, it's never wasted material, but I generally only write when I feel like I've got something to say. And I think it's been about 6 weeks, maybe more, since I wrote my last post. I do start to get twitchy, like I need to do it and I need to keep it updated, but it's just, you know, there's nobody chasing me to say, where's your blog post? Whereas if I hadn't, you know, submitted edited chapters or turned up for publicity events or what have you, then that kind of feels like the job at the moment.
That was Sarah Turner there, and her latest book, The Unmumsy Mum Diary, is out now and published by Bantam Press. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is debut novelist Megan Hunter. Megan, talking to Sarah there about humour, her books are very funny. There is quite a lot of humour in your novel.
Oh, I'm very pleased to hear that. I'm always so happy when people sort of notice or appreciate the humour in the book, because I did want it to have that aspect, definitely. I mean, a lot of my favourite books are funny, and I love a sort of wit in books. It's a very important thing to me. So although, you know, a lot of the time the book is quite dark, I hope that there are these sort of moments of humour that shine through.
I wonder if because it's dark, some people don't recognise the humour there.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that because it's written in the way that it is, and there's so much space for the reader, that actually, you know, that it's hugely open to interpretation. There are very, very different responses to it. So that's fair enough as well if you don't read it in a funny way. But I certainly wrote it intending for it to be perhaps not laugh out loud funny all the time, but, you know, definitely those sort of little lighter moments.
They're definitely there. Well, we'll hear your second choice of music now, which is Breathing by Kate Bush. Why this one?
Well, I love Kate Bush. I find her, you know, as you said, to pick some music that I find inspiring. I find her just generally a very inspiring person. And this particular song is about, you know, having a baby, or perhaps even being a baby at a time of great, great disaster. So it's relevant to the book, and it's also just very beautiful.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest today is Megan Hunter, talking about her novel, The End We Start From. And you're going to read for us now, Megan.
I'm in the hospital when R comes to tell me, but I already know. The reports have spread through the ward like infection. In the bed across from me, a girl, possibly just young enough to be my granddaughter, cuddles her toddler on one side and her newborn on the other. Schoolboys visit her and let their eyes roam over my udders as they pass. I am veined and topless, doing skin to skin with the boy, who is mysterious and silent. Occasionally he twitches, as though remembering something. In the night, a nurse with hunched shoulders like the start of wings comes to my bedside and lifts him to me. She says his eyes look like shark's eyes. They all do. The lady through the curtain has no baby. Well, she has one, but he is upstairs in a plastic box filled with wires and tubes, and she wails out for more drugs. Crash section, I hear the midwives murmuring. They give her the drugs. She has a radio and doesn't use headphones. She has her pain and no baby, so I don't say anything. She likes talk radio mostly, interminable phone-ins in different accents that all pass through my body in the same way. The phrases spill out, unstoppable. Deck chairs, document, pressure, response. They seem to swell from under me like a bath filling up, like indigestion, like something no bad simile could ever do justice to. I'm eating lime jelly with the boy in the crook of my arm when I hear. His hands circle in tiny, victorious fists. I feel that I could, all things considered, conquer the world. The news on the hour, 14th of June, 1 o'clock. Tina Murphy reporting. An unprecedented flood. London. Uninhabitable. A list of boroughs like the shipping forecast. Their names suddenly as perfect and tender as the names of children. Ours. 2 hours later, R is there, breaking the news again, lifting the boy against his shoulder, apologising like it's his fault. The hospital now seems to be a ship, a brightly lit ark housing all the new ones aloft. We, the women in the open-backed gowns, bursting stitches in the bathroom, are their escorts. The food becomes a lot worse.
Thank you, Megan. That idea of London under water, this dystopian future, mm-hmm. is science fiction, really. Is that a genre that you'd been interested in before?
I'm interested in it. I mean, I've read some books in that genre. I wouldn't say that I was thinking a lot about genre when I wrote it. I was more thinking about disaster, really, the nature of disaster. And I think that my sort of imagination has always been quite preoccupied with disaster, and I don't think that disaster need actually be solely a science fiction concept. And I mean, it's this disaster. I'm not a scientist, but it's plausible, at least in the future. So it's not something that has to be completely outside of the realm of our reality. But yeah, I mean, I'm certainly interested in ideas that go beyond the norm of the everyday, and in sort of in having my imagination stretched by that. Really, I read very and watch and listen very, very broadly. I don't sort of shut myself off to any form or genre.
And there's a lot about trauma in there as well.
Yes.
The trauma of birth, of death, of separation, of moving home.
Yes, I mean, I think I'm really interested in the trauma. This sounds perhaps overly negative, but the trauma in terms of a very, very impactful event of having children. I mean, it can be a trauma more for some people than others, but in this book it's really putting that alongside a global trauma and really that physical experience. It becomes the experience of the whole world. And I'm interested in the book in exploring how trauma affects language. So come back to that sense of the language being broken. And also there's often a real emphasis in the book about how words change, how language changes in the face of trauma, how the words, the physicality of the words actually becomes more apparent, the way that things feel in our mouths to say, and the way that words take on completely different meanings, really. The word, she says in the book, the word home has lost its meaning.
Yeah, well, there's a lot about, I mean, given what's happening in Syria and various parts of the world, it's interesting to look at this country. What if we were forced to be refugees or migrants within our own country?
Yeah, I think that's very much what the book asks and what I was asking. And I think, you know, it's not trying to sort of paint a realistic picture of other people's refugee experiences, of course, but it is trying to imagine if that did happen here, and I suppose bring it closer to home. You know, it's often we think about these things happening to other people, to somebody else, to somebody far away. And yes, we might have feelings of sympathy or compassion, but they're always at a distance. Whereas actually, you know, this is happening to people just like us, you know, who have young children just like we do. And I think that I hope that sort of what I wanted with the narrator was to very, very much inhabit that experience completely from within, of being a refugee, a displaced person in this country.
It is quite disturbing for the reader to read about our country, the country we know, with refugee camps in it and checkpoints in it. The refugee camp sequence is very vivid. How did you research that?
Well, I mean, I think I would certainly say I'm writing about camps, an imagined camp here, an imagined camp in Scotland. So you have, you know, you have porridge, you have baby groups. There are comforts which I'm sure don't exist in many other refugee camps. But I was hearing at the time that I was writing it, I was hearing, you know, stories on the radio, first person stories, programs like From Our Own Correspondent. I think it's a wonderful program where you really hear from individual people, individual families who've been displaced. And perhaps that got me thinking, you know, what if that happened here? What if that happened to me or somebody like me?
Right, well, we're here now. We'll take a slight sideways step. We're going to hear another winning entry from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. The theme of the competition was location as inspiration, with entrants invited to write about places in Cambridge. The story we'll hear now is Rain and Sun by Sienna Brodie Gold, which was a runner-up in the 12 to 16-year-old category.
I swing my legs, dangling them over the edge of the bright blue bus seat, having just beaten my sister to the window spot. She sits frowning with her arms crossed. I just giggle. The bus moves slowly round the roundabout, as if time itself was slowing all around me. And I stretch up, peering over, out of the window at the vivid scenery. Jesus Green swimming pool, the empty Staples parking lot, old medieval pubs still standing tall, lined up next to the river cam. Old houses lined up in an orderly row, all tall and elegant, with shiny black metal fences with spiky edges. As the bus stops at a traffic light, a red squirrel blinks up at me in intrigue. I smile back happily as it munches its way through a nut. My grandpa turns to me and says, "Sienna, it's time to press the button." I smile, reaching out eagerly, stretching from my seat, only to hear the familiar binging noise and see my sister wearing a smug smile, cheekily grinning. "Beat you!" she exclaims, smirking, and I frown as I'm led off the bus. I step outside and a sly grin creeps onto my face. I'm led away into what seemed like a vast and wild world, like I was the size of a pea in a pile of mattresses, or the size of a fairy in a Sleeping Beauty castle. I walk through the busy market, my mouth slightly open, and with a shocked stare as I see the steady flow of rush hour. People doing early Christmas shopping, eating strange foods, and the large queue of impatient customers looking at their watches, waiting to get back to their work before being told off by their bosses, but not before they fuel up on their daily lunchtime caffeine dose. My hand is squeezed tightly as I'm guided through the market, staring up in awe at all the stalls, each one a different variant of the same coloured stripy roofs, each stall different to the rest, selling groceries, fruits, cheeses, juice, jewellery. My eyes light up as my gaze falls upon the stand. The particular stand that always seems to invigorate my mood. The sweet stand, with the rainbow-coloured sweets, from fudge to chocolate and gummy bears to bubblegum. Something twinkles in my eyes as I inhale the sugary smell, letting the aroma of the cables take over my thoughts. The cables, all lined up in a row, with hundreds of flavours. Sour watermelon, marshmallow, bubblegum, strawberry, raspberry, lime, tutti frutti. I can never choose which flavour. After what feels like hours of begging, I finally manage to persuade my grandpa to buy me one. The only snag being my sister gets one too. I'm dragged off again, led up to Great St. Mary's Church, The antique framed doorway painted the same sickly brown to match the surrounding walls. Oh, the stairs seem to go on forever, spiralling up to where my view doesn't reach. As I walk past, the bells ring deafeningly, leaving an echo in my ears. After several "are we there yets?", we finally at the top. I peer over the edge as my teeth chatter, and I pull a dull face as I feel a drop of rain fall on the very centre of my head. I shiver. "Let's go back inside," my grandpa says, and I follow, holding my sister's hand obediently as she curls her wrists in her jacket, making scuffling noises with her pink wellies. As we stand at the bottom of the stairs, on the aisles, I hear the loud pitter-pattering of raindrops colliding with the roof, making it nearly impossible to hear what we're saying. My grandpa pulls out the same grey umbrella from his Cambridge University bag. It's curious, but every time we go out, he has a different shade of the same bag. Today it's a bright yellow. Last time was grey. The time before it was scarlet red. We step outside and huddle under the umbrella as my grandpa squeezes my frozen hand with his. The warm feeling sends jolts through my body, and my sister clutches onto mine, trying to steal my excess warmth. We quickly walk through the streets and turn down the familiar alley, my very favourite. As we walk past, I peer into the restaurant, which always appears to be empty, apart from one or two people. I always wonder about that. Light flickers in my eyes as they fall on the familiar Heifers sign, and I skip into the shop, knowing that I will be allowed one book. I smile widely as my eyes scan the shelves looking for my favourite, Roald Dahl. Flicking through my favourite books, making sure to read every blurb twice, I finally pick my favourite, Matilda. The thrill never goes with Roald Dahl. It pumps through my bloodstream. We check out the book and I turn to my sister. "What did you get?" She holds up the Gruffalo. I let out a giggle. "Come on," my grandpa says, and we walk down the street, one of my favourites. Yo Sushi, Pylons, Clark's, into the Grand Arcade. My sister ogles over the Build-A-Bear workshop, and we take the lift to the Central Library. I pick out my favourite Jacqueline Wilson and smirk smugly as I eat my chocolate cake afterwards. I wipe the crumbs from my mouth and scrub my hands on my pink button-up coat. We step outside and I feel the cold breeze on my legs, though my sister appears fine. I don't understand how she can wear an A skirt and top with a thin jacket and not be cold. It bugs me. I huddle against her and we walk to the bus stop, just managing to catch a bus. I run to the top and sit at the front eagerly, swinging my legs to and fro, just as it starts to bucket down. I jump from my seat when a branch brushes the bus. Grey clouds coat the sky in a thick storm. And I wonder how it could possibly have been over 20 degrees earlier. I love Cambridge. Always will. But the one thing I will never understand is how you can get roasted alive, then drenched in rain and still have fun. Because it is fun. I love Cambridge. I love my home.
That was Rain and Sun by Sienna Brodie Gould, read there by Emma Harpley. Are you a Cambridge girl, Megan?
I am, yes. I've lived here since I was about two, kind of off and on. I have been away. I've lived in America and I went away for university, but then came back for my master's, and I've been here ever since, so most of my life.
You wouldn't go anywhere else?
I don't think so, no. Now, I mean, it's funny. It's living somewhere where you have so many layered memories is an interesting thing. And I used to think, oh, I've got to go and live somewhere else. You know, I can't live here all my life. But now I've got used to it, and I almost can't imagine living somewhere where I don't have so many associations and memories.
And what next for you now? I guess at the moment you're working hard to promote The End We Start From.
Yeah, I've got quite a lot of events coming up, but I'm definitely writing in between, working on my second book. And it's important to me to keep writing, really, because that's what I love doing, and that's what kind of keeps me grounded. And I'm writing and reading, and obviously my children are at school now, but you know,
some more time
doing the school run.
The school run. And without giving too much away, will the second novel be in the same format as the first?
I don't think it will be, certainly won't be in exactly the same form. I think before I wrote The End We Start From, I was doing a lot of experimenting really in lots of different forms, writing lots of different things, and the last year has been another process of that, and kind of really my style, I think, is definitely evolving. Watch this space.
And it's going
cheesily.
Watch this space. It's going to be hotly anticipated. I suppose having a very successful first novel is a lovely position to be in. But do you feel the pressure of a second?
A little bit. I wrote a story about it, actually, about writing a second book in relation to having one second child. And certainly the second book is a sort of notoriously tricky thing, but I think you have to take your mind off that to an extent and just keep going.
And we mentioned the film rights, and I'm suspecting you can't say too much about that either. But do you have any hand in that, or is that being developed separately?
I certainly will be sort of... consulted, and we'll be, you know, talking about that, but it is a separate project. It's not something I'll be sort of directly hands-on with, but I'm very excited to see, you know, to see what comes of it. And it's very exciting, but it's sort of happening in another place to my my solitary room where I'm writing my books.
And we ask this of every guest on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've just finished a superb thriller. Really, it is. I don't read that many thrillers, but it is. It's a sort of murder mystery called In the Cut by Susanna Moore. It was recommended to me by my agent, Emma Patterson. I do always take her recommendations, and it really is excellent. It's out of print in the UK, but you can get hold of it. And it's very, very good. It also has a lot about language, and the narrator is a sort of obsessed with language. And I've just finished that, and then I've just started really Muriel Spark, The Driver's Seat, which is a very short, compact novel. I'm always interested to sort of check out other very short novels. I'm interested in the sort of short novel form. And I've heard, just looking at the back now, her spiny and treacherous masterpiece, it says. I've heard extremely good things about this.
Spiny and treacherous, that sounds good,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, indeed.
What have you got lined up? Do you have anything lined up after Muriel's finished?
Oh, I do. I have to say I have a slightly embarrassingly high TBR pile, as they call it, teetering on my bed, that's threatening to squash me. I'm reading quite a lot of poetry at the moment. I'm reading Emily Berry's new book and Ocean Vuong's book. I like to read, you know, in lots of different genres, really, and like to read novels and then poetry and then essays. And I'm reading Durga Chu Boyce's book, Too Much and Not the Mood. I'm trying to, you know, your mind goes blank when you're trying to flick through that pile. That's a very high and teetering pile.
That does sound familiar. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Megan Hunter today about The End We Start From, which is published by Picador. We're going to come back to you in just a moment, Megan, to hear your final choice of music. But on our next show, studio guest will be writer Katie Dell. We'll also hear Jan Todd talking about her biography of restoration playwright Afra Behn, and the final tranche of winners from the Rock Road Library writing competition. And just a reminder, as always, that podcasts of all the previous Bookmarks are up on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk, and they're all there since the beginning of time. We've been going 3 or 4 years, so quite a few to get through. But we'll finish now with your final track of music. Great track. This is Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark. Why this one?
Well, I love Bruce Springsteen, and this book contains this line that always makes me laugh about sitting here trying to write this book. So it's really both the frustration but also the exhilaration of writing, particularly when it's going well.
I get up in the evening and I ain't got nothing.